field for a really long time. We went and traveled at the federal level, 8 different
Good
states.
Morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. We have a couple different things we're going to be doing today. We have one public hearing, a work session, and then an informational hearing. Knowing that we're going to spend more time on the informational meeting, what we're going to do is go ahead and clear the other two. So I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 602. Laura?
Yes, Chair Prezansky, members of the committee. Senate Bill 602 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. We have no revenue impact, and we may have a fiscal impact. No statement issued there yet. We do have a proposed Dash 1 amendment before us today. It would add 2 additional members to the task force we're going to talk about for a total of 17. Those individuals would represent We come from organizations representing individuals with intellectual disabilities or individuals with developmental disabilities or seniors. So Senate Bill 602 creates a task force on criminal records checks for professions that involve essential services. It requires the task force to study the use of criminal records checks to evaluate prospective employees for certain professions that provide care and services to vulnerable individuals. It also requires a cost-benefit analysis of requiring those criminal records checks and the types of crimes at issue. The bill outlines the task force's assignment as well as the rules of operation. It declares an emergency clause, and it also contains a sunset provision taking effect on December 31st, 2016.
All right, thank you. Melissa and Joel, y'all are too signed up, so why don't y'all come forward. While they're coming up, is there going to be anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 602?
Chair Prezansky, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill. For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director of SEIU Local 503. And this bill is really meant to be a simple look back. In 2009, a bill passed that created a list of crimes that where employees are automatically disqualified from employment. And that list is out there, and now we want to look and see over the last 5 years what's been the impact of that and what's the ongoing benefit and cost-benefit analysis, really, of keeping that. We think that there's definitely clearly benefits to having a list of crimes that people who do essential services should not be able to do this work if they've committed certain crimes. We also think that it's appropriate that we review that and make sure that people who are not and unintentionally getting caught up in the law. And that's the goal of this task force. It's that simple. There's no predetermined outcome of the task force. We'd like to get people who are experienced this in lots of different ways, both the people who are doing the work, the people who are administering the background checks, the people who are actually having the services delivered for them, and then also experts on this come together and discuss it and see where we want to go. And maybe we do nothing, and maybe we make changes because there has but we just would like to have the conversation. That's the goal of this bill. It's pretty straightforward and simple, and we're hoping that we can start their work soon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Joe?
Chair Prezansky, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. We're very supportive of this bill and the amendment also that we've seen. I don't know if you've seen it, but we've heard about it. I believe it. I have just 2 quick stories how this came to our attention. Not to belabor the issue, I think everything Melissa said I totally agree with. We had a member in Multnomah County who 25 years ago had a domestic violence situation, and it resulted in a car accident where her boyfriend, who was abusive, was killed. And this happened in a different state a long time ago. She had sort of like moved on. Her life had gotten so much better and changed. And then 25 years later at Multnomah County, she went to apply for a manager's position, which is a little sad because she's a great member, but went to apply for a manager's position. And then they did a background check and found out that she couldn't have that position. It turned out she spent her own money on an attorney who did more research and found out that she had actually been put on probation and not gotten a conviction, and it ended up being okay. But it still spent months and months of her life and trauma in her life, and you know, it rehashed all these things. And I should say, I don't know what this bill will accomplish for her, but it was a sort of situation that sort of flagged it for us in our union, that in the vast majority of cases, the law as it stands probably works really well. But there are these few exceptions that I think we need to, like, at least take a look at, a second look, as Melissa said. And then the other situation, we had a member 12 years ago who was trying to adopt three kids. One of the kids, the middle child, had a got on antidepressants before the FDA had said stop giving antidepressants to children. That she had had a very bad reaction and tried to harm herself. It became a very damaging spiral in their family. They stopped the adoption process, and a caseworker had sort of marked him as a threat of harm 15 years ago, and he didn't even know that it had happened. In the sort of like trauma of trying to end the adoption process, he went to try to apply for a managerial job at DHS, and the same thing sort of happened. It was like he had no idea it happened. When it was happening 15 years ago, he hadn't really realized what it would have meant for his future and his life later on. He was just trying to solve the situation at the same time. I think that our desire for this bill is not to sort of overturn the apple cart or change everything. I'll try to use more metaphors, but it's to sort of just take a look and see if there are exceptions or things that maybe we want to have another chance to look at. But that's it. Thank you.
Question, sir, Senator Gelfand, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment and a question. And I appreciate and support this task force and having the second look. This was my bill in 2009 that created the list, which is a much narrower list than what applies to people that are teaching in school. And the place that it came from was at that time we had learned that one in four individuals with developmental disabilities in state care had been significantly abused in the prior couple of years, many of them three or more times. So we really wanted to look at workplace safety. So one of the questions I have about that second instance is whether this would cover that, because a threat of harm wouldn't be in a criminal record. It would be in the abuse registry at DHS, since that wouldn't go into the – will this
– Senator Brzezinski, Senator Gelser, I'm not entirely sure. I'm sorry. I wish I knew. I mean, I think how it was explained to me is he had a background check before moving through his promotion, and that's when it triggered. I'm not sure the specifics of his situation. He didn't, frankly, want to get into a lot of detail. I think it was probably still very, very painful for him. He looked it over, and I think he attributed the problem to the law. Whether that's actually accurate, I don't know. I think it's just sort of it highlights an example of a situation that could something like that could occur. I'm not specific enough.
Follow up. I think one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years is technology has gotten better, and there's better cross-looking across agencies with internal reports. I think many things have been attributed back to the law. So our office has spent a lot of time chasing things down, and usually it's not the law. There are a couple of convictions that seem to be sweeping people up. There's a burglary conviction in particular that seems to be impacting young people and college students. But it might be worthwhile in the task force to look at what are the things that are popping up, and how is that information shared?
Yeah.
All right. Any other questions, comments? Thank y'all very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask again, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 602? Not seeing, we'll close the public hearing on 602. We're going to go ahead and open up our work session on Senate Bill 383. Laura, if you can bring us up to speed, please.
Absolutely. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 383 came to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. We previously had a public hearing on this bill on February 11th. We do have some amendments before us today. We have the proposed Dash 3 amendment that removes language participating in the same jurisdiction to clarify meaning and intent. It deletes original from page 1, line 12, to provide flexibility in amending claims. We've got some non-substantive Scrivener's changes. The Dash 3 amendment is ready to move. There was a contemplated Dash 4 amendment, but the parties have agreed to move forward with the Dash 3. So just to provide some background, ORS 31.300 contains Oregon's Certificate of Merit statute outlining requirements for bringing a claim against a design professional. The intent of that statute is to help determine which claims against design professionals lack basis and which warrant the court's attention. Senate Bill 383 clarifies the Certificate of Merit statute by amending claims requirements. The bill provides an exemption to claims requirements for public bodies. Additionally, it only applies to complaints, cross-claims, counterclaims, and third-party claims filed on or after its effective date.
All right, thank you. So, colleagues, we are ready to move the dash threes, but I want to give everyone an opportunity. If you want to get more detail on the dash threes, we can bring people up, but if we're ready to move it, we're ready to go.
I'm good.
We'll take the motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 383.
Senator Cruz moves the dash three amendment into Senate Bill 383. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 383 as amended by the dash three amendments to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 383 as amended by the dash threes to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Chair will carry Senate Bill 383 to the floor. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 383. And before I do that, I do want to thank the parties that have worked through this process. I know it was one that took a little bit of time to kind of work some wrinkles out. And as we've always known, that we'll see how this works. Hopefully it does what it's intended to do. And if not, well, if we need to revisit it in the future, we'll do so. So thank you all very much. With that, we'll close the work session. And now we're going to go ahead and go into our informational meeting, which I'll go ahead and gavel in. And Laura, why don't you give us a little overview of what we're going to be doing?
So we've invited some parties in to discuss Senate Bill 341 that has been proposed that provides agritourism providers are not liable for injury to or death of participants arising out of inherent risks of agritourism if agritourism provider posts certain notices. That the bill provides exceptions. It does declare an emergency and is effective on passage. But we wanted some folks to come in and just tell us about agritourism more generally as well. So we do have five individuals with us today to tell us about agritourism in Oregon.
All right, thank you. I understand we're going to have two panels from what I understand at this point that we've invited testimony from. So I think what we'll do is start with Bill Cross, I believe Scotty Jones, and Ivan Molusky. I think that's who I have right now. And I'm assuming I have the ones that are coming to the dais are going to be more the proponents for moving forward on this.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Destination Marketing Organizations, and appreciate the opportunity to make a few comments about agritourism. I will defer to my partners to get into some of the details, but just wanted to give you a little background. Late 2012, early 2013, that some of my members, which are the destination marketing organizations around the state, like Travel Portland, Travel Salem, all over the state, some of them had identified agritourism liability issues as a barrier to the promotion, or as a barrier to agritourism in general, which is a hot growing segment of tourism here in Oregon. And it came out at one of the conferences on agritourism, a general conference on marketing, promotion, development of the industry, that this was a growing issue as the industry grew. So I got a copy of a North Carolina bill, had heard that a number of states had addressed this issue by promoting liability limitations if farmers put out posted signs, warning signs, and that type of thing. And sure enough, got a legislative copy of a statute from North Carolina, which we introduced as Senate Bill 815. But it was late in the session, and it really didn't get a chance to get worked. However, Chair Brzezinski indicated he would ask appoint a work group to look at this issue further in the interim. And it was also, I think, about that time that the National Conference of State Legislators did a report here in Oregon, did a presentation here in Oregon on rural tourism, rural economic growth, and identified this as one of the issues that many state legislators were addressing in terms of agritourism, jobs, economy in the rural area. I will let my panelists or my co-panelists talk about the work group and the process that evolved after the 2013 session.
Yeah, and just for clarification, Bill Cross and I had talked about this, and I said I thought it would be great to try to get the different perspectives of people together for this work group. So this is going to kind of hopefully give us some insight as to what has happened versus what hasn't and the needs for it, and then we'll be hearing as to some of the concerns that I know that have been raised. So who would like to go first?
I could go next. Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. We represent small and mid-sized farms across the state with over 5,000 members and supporters, and really appreciate the opportunity to talk about both agritourism and address some of the issues around Senate Bill 341 as well. First off, we strongly support the ability of farmers and ranchers to engage in agritourism opportunities and urge and ultimately urge your support for this concept, this bill. Agritourism activities, generally speaking, are, should we move back a little bit? A little closer. All right. Agritourism activities in general are something that growing numbers of farms and ranches are doing as a way to earn extra income, expose their customers to on-farm activities. It's a great way for the public to learn where their food comes from, how it's grown. It creates some good connections between rural and urban Oregon. It can include things like UPIC operations, harvest your own, farm stays, corn mazes, what have you. Educational field trips, all sorts of those kinds of issues, recreational, educational, and cultural activities on farms. However, as Bill noted, agritourism operators face a lot of legal risk when they invite members of the public onto their property. And as a result of this, there are actually very few companies that will provide liability insurance for such activities. And that means that if you can get your operation insured, you might have to pay a very high price to do so. So this ultimately presents a real obstacle to success. You know, back in 2011, the legislature passed Senate Bill 960, which incorporated agritourism activities into the land use statutes on what you can and can't do on exclusive farm use zones. So there's a history of the legislature looking at this issue and finding ways to promote agritourism activities. So this liability insurance question is kind of a next step in terms of how we make sure we can do this right in Oregon. Some of the inherent risks, obviously, that people could face on farms are uneven ground, slippery surfaces, just the nature of buildings or equipment that are on the property, domestic animals, wild animals, and frankly, the potential that members of the public may fail to follow directions and act negligently on their own while they're on your property and cause harm to others. The liability waiver in this bill is a little different from some of the other states because of this work group process. And I'll just jump ahead really briefly and say, as Bill noted, Senate Bill 815 was up for discussion 2 years ago. The Judiciary Committee staff convened a work group over the interim. Participants in that included Friends of Family Farmers, the Oregon Farm Bureau, 1,000 Friends of Oregon, or the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association were part of the discussion, individual agritourism providers, the Oregon Destination Marketing Organizations, Oregon Department of Agriculture, Clackamas County, Country Financial Insurance, Travel Oregon, and more. So we had a wide array of folks talking about this issue and how to have an Oregon-specific bill addressing these topics. It's our understanding that that over 20 states now have these statutes in place. North Carolina was the first. And most recently, we've seen Wisconsin, Florida, Idaho, and Oklahoma add these liability protections. A lot of the language is similar, but in some of the differences for our approach here in Oregon include well, some of these are the same, but some of them are different, and I can flag those out. But the liability waiver would not exempt an agritourism provider if they actually commit an act or omission that constitutes willful or wanton disregard for the safety of their participants, and the act of that or omission is the cause of the injury. They're not protected if they intentionally injure participants. They're not protected if they provide equipment to participants that and fail to make reasonable and prudent inspection of that equipment, and that ends up harming folks. And if they fail to post signs warning of latent condition on the land or the facilities that are known or should be known to the agritourism provider. One difference that we added here was if they, they're also not protected if they fail to obtain necessary authorization for the agritourism activity under ORS 215.213 through 283, which describes the permitted uses on exclusive farm use zones. And so that's an effort to make sure that we're not encouraging activities on exclusive farm use zones that wouldn't otherwise be permitted. So that's, I think, an important distinction and what makes one of the pieces that makes our approach unique here. And additionally, as sort of noted, the agritourism provider is required in the bill to conspicuously post a notice that is specified in the bill itself at the entrance of the agritourism site, at any location where the activity takes place, and in every written contract between the agritourism provider and the participant. And for your viewing, I've attached a photograph of something that's very similar that we already have in Oregon law. Oregon has a similar statute called the Equine Activity Statute, ORS 30.687, which essentially allows equine sponsors and professionals to be protected from legal liability for the death or injury of participants arising out of equine activities like riding horses, training, driving, grooming, unless there's wanton, willful, or intentional disregard for their safety. So in many ways, we view the agritourism liability approach that we're looking at 341 as an extension of this already existing liability protections for equine activities. And as you can imagine, many equine activities are not particularly safe inherently. And so, but they have, you know, but this is something, and this sign that I've provided you a picture of, you can buy at many farm stores across Oregon. And so we see it as an extension of that. The last piece I'll just add, since we're kind of talking generally as well, is, you know, I tried to look at a few of the other state statutes. Again, they are very similar in nature. We added a land use component to make sure we weren't promoting activities that shouldn't be happening in exclusive farm use zones. Other states have perhaps, you know, maybe been a little more specific on the size of the sign or the size of the lettering. Those are really easy issues to deal with as this discussion moves forward. And so, you know, I would urge you to take a look at this and keep the discussion going. We'd like to see a work session on this bill ultimately, and I'll turn it over to Scotty at this point to talk a little bit more about her operation and some of the benefits they're seeing from agritourism. Thank you.
So, Senator Przanski and members of the committee, thank you for letting me tell you a little bit about what I do in my own agritourism operation. My name is Scotty Jones. I own Leaping Lamb Farm with my husband. We're in Alsea, about 25 miles west of Corvallis. And I'm going to start this slideshow, and I'm going to let it roll through, because this kind of shows, maybe I'm going to start the slideshow. Oh, hang on, let me get this. Or maybe it's loading. This just is going to give you an example of the kinds of things that happen on our farm. And while that's loading, I've been a sheep farmer since 2003. We moved here from Arizona. I used to work at the Phoenix Zoo, and the only thing I knew about farming at that time was the farm that was actually on at the zoo, because Arizona hasn't done a lot to protect its farms. And I've been an agritourism operator, however, since 2006 when we opened our farm stay, because not realizing the economies of small farming, excuse me, when we moved here, we realized we were using our retirement to pay to be farmers. And I knew that how important it was and how important it had been for me when we got this farm to understand farming. I'm also the founder and the executive director of the U.S. Farm Stay Association, which is a national association, trade association, 501c6. So I'm familiar with what other farm stays operations are like here in Oregon and also around the country and the challenges that they have. And I've been part of the Travel Oregon work group on agritourism, and also helped organize that first agritourism summit that Bill was referring to that was at OSU. So the kinds of things that I offer my guests when they come is a way to connect with the farmer, because urbanites are very disconnected these days and don't really know what we do.
I offer people the opportunity to come out into the country to touch nature, to do things that we all did as children, and a lot of children don't have the opportunity to do that anymore. Living in the city, to eat fresh eggs, to pull vegetables out of the garden, to even identify what those vegetables are. I've had people who wanted to go out and pick spinach, and they pulled the leaves off the broccoli. So it's important for them to have some concept and connection with what we do. And the other agritourism operations in Oregon would be things like pumpkin patches at Easy Orchards. It would be like the Tulip Festival that's going on right now at Wooden Shoe Farm. It would be you-pick operations for strawberries and blueberries, even you-cut operations on for Christmas trees. And then, as was mentioned, school groups that like to come out and see what we do. I get school groups from ALSI that come out to see our turkeys for Thanksgiving. So it's a way that we can educate urbanites about what small-scale farming is and why it's important. And the reality is it's important for what I think is the most serious reason is rural economic development. Because my guests don't just stay with me. They shop at our local store. They buy gas at our local gas station. They go to our local cafe. And they even, you know, they participate in some of the county parks. They go up to ALSI Falls. It's also important for small farm sustainability. We need something else to do. We don't have the economies of scale that large-scale farms do. And you know what we do? We provide the face of agriculture for people these days because people aren't going to go on to those really, really big farms. Those farmers don't have time. So we make that connection to food, where your food is grown, what it looks like, what those farmers do, what kind of work is involved. And the people take that back to the cities, and that helps them make healthier food choices. It helps them understand why the prices are like they are for organic food or at the farmer's market. And so we're teaching people, and I know that's something that the legislature has been interested in terms of healthy food for kids, farm to school. A lot of us do that kind of thing because we're at that scale of operation. As was mentioned, there are a lot of other, this is not a new kind of idea to have a limited liability agritourism bill. There are about 22 other states that have done it. The most recent have been Idaho and Colorado. And again, it's similar kind of to the equine liability law in terms of what we're asking. We're not talking about limiting liability on everything. We know that we're responsible to point out to our guests what's dangerous, and I've discovered that if accidents happen, they happen in the first 30 minutes when people are on site. They're not familiar with the terrain, they're not familiar with what's going on, so I take them on something that I actually call the danger tour, and I point out everything that's dangerous about our farm. And it's kind of, you know, it's similar to me. When I came here a couple years ago, I fell down by stepping on a piece of marble outside as I was rushing to get here. So it's just, I was unfamiliar with this terrain. So it's just similar. We're just trying to come up with some protections that way. And this kind of bill will reduce the anxiety that I have when people come on my site. I may take them on a danger tour, but I want to make sure they're safe. I want them to return. I want them to tell their friends about the opportunities that they had with us and what they learned. And so my final thoughts on this would just be that I thought we had a reasonable compromise this fall in terms of where this bill was going, and then something happened. So I would just ask the committee if you'd be willing to work on it again. And we're not talking about limiting liability on everything, but we need to balance the opportunity our agritourism enterprises offer to urbanites with the liabilities we take on when we offer to share our lifestyle and our farms with them. Thank you very much for letting me say my piece, and if you have any questions, I'm more than happy to answer.
Well, thank you very much. Let me ask if there are any questions for anyone on the panel at this point. Bill?
Chair Przanski, one other comment I'd like to make is that we're trying to find a way. I mean, agritourism operators want to protect their guests, and they want to protect their investments, their farms, and insurance is very difficult to secure right now. There aren't very many insurers that offer this kind of coverage, and it's expensive. And legislation will help. The years ago, when I worked on the liquor liability reform here in the state, and we were able to finally get, it didn't seem like an awful lot, but we got a dram shop reform, and all of a sudden we had, instead of just Lloyd's of London offering expensive dram shop insurance to a small number of restaurants, we had three or four insurers that came back into the market, and slowly, as a couple cases wound their way through the courts, it became at least a more reasonable insurance line, and so we ended up with better rates and more coverage. And a lot of the bar and tavern owners, that's what they wanted, the ability to have that insurance. So that's what we were hoping to achieve through this work group and would like to see further discussion.
Okay, let me just ask, Gotti, since you brought this up in your testimony about where the work group was this past fall, I didn't hear you go into any detail. Do you feel comfortable kind of giving the committee your perspective of what you thought was, close to being
gonna happen.
Acknowledged?
Sure. We've had several meetings, and this fall, there did seem to be a problem. The Trial Lawyers Association really was not happy originally with the way we had written up the bill, and so I think that Bill had, we had made some amendments and addendums to how it would look to try to satisfy that, and I thought at the last meeting we were at that we were all on the same page and that we were going to move forward with submitting our ideas for how the bill should go forward, and then I was told that it had been tabled. So that's just my understanding of it, and I don't know why, and I...
Okay. Well, that's fine. I just want to get a perspective. So what we're going to do is, Senator Burdick, I don't know if you had any questions. I already asked the panel if you had any questions on this or not. So I think what we're going to do is we'll get y'all to step back. We'll have the other group come up, and then we'll figure out next steps.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. So at this point, I have Art Towers, Derek Johnson, and Art, was there anyone else besides Derek? Okay.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, the political director for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I had the pleasure to participate in several of the work group meetings. It was kind of my first task after joining the trial lawyers, and the work group was a positive experience. I think we exchanged a lot of good information, had good conversations, but at the end of the day, we weren't able to reach consensus about how to move forward. I think that the big thing from our perspective is that a slip and fall in the mud is one thing, but issues around hay rides and tractors and unsafe buildings are quite another. And so, as you heard the description of agritourism, and as a grandfather to five beautiful granddaughters, I enjoy agritourism quite a bit. But at the same time, I'm really nervous about the young person driving the tractor not carrying a load of hay in his hay wagon, but carrying a load of kids in his hay wagon. And if something happens, I want to make sure that my granddaughters are protected, and so I worry quite a bit about that. The variety of agritourism activities is broad. Some were mentioned. We talked about the farm buildings that, as I understand it, have relaxed standards, unlike buildings that have to meet more stringent building codes. The new thing is pumpkin guns, and I know that members of this committee are very, very concerned about pumpkin gun safety. And so, it's those sorts of issues that that we're worried about. In the work group itself, there were a variety of different perspectives brought and that aren't reflected in today's conversation. The moment when I went from hopeful that we could reach a compromise is we reached with the design professionals, and the bill you moved earlier today, was when the insurance industry representative said, there is no way the legislation that you pass in Oregon is going to change the rates. We had talked, one of the earlier points that was made was that the insurance rates are really challenging for the agritourism industry. And when the woman from the insurance industry said, no way, this is a nationally rated industry, there are safety issues, and we're not going to change the rates regardless of what you do in Oregon, that's when I felt like, we are not going to get where we need to get to. The other perspective that was brought forward that isn't part of today's informational hearing was that of the public health sector. With a representative from Clackamas County come speak to some of those issues and some of the unintended consequences related to that set of issues. And so, I did commend the agritourism industry. I thought they were pretty reasonable, pretty forthright, pretty willing to listen. I felt like we came forward with some language that I thought made a little bit of progress, but didn't ultimately get the job done. And so, as a customer in this business transaction with the agritourism industry, I have some sympathy, but at the end of the day, I want to make sure that consumers are safe, and we felt like this bill would not get the job done. And in closing, I just want to introduce the next witness, Mr. Derek Johnson, who can set this issue in a little bit broader context, because the issue of blanket immunity is a big one facing the legislature. There's, I think, 7 or 8 different bills going on out there, and I think that context, just a couple minutes on that, might be helpful for the committee.
Thank you. Hi, Derek. Members of the committee, Senator Przanski, my name is Derek Johnson. I'm the past president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I'm the co-chair of the Legislative Committee. when Arthur first asked me to come and talk about this subject, I said, well, what's not to like about immunization? I mean, polio and smallpox, those are ringing successes. He kicked me under the table and said, Derek, we're talking about immunity from civil liability. So I felt a little bit like Gilda Radner there. Never mind. That's sort of a reaction that I get from a lot of people when I first talk about immunity. They don't understand sort of the background or the principles that go into these civil immunity provisions that seem to pop up fairly regularly now over the last 10, 15 years in legislative sessions. They pop up when a trade group or a profession wants to have some protection from liability. And the argument typically is what we heard today from the agritourism industry, that we need immunity to be able to do our good work. We need immunity to be able to run our businesses. We need immunity so that we are protected if we do something unreasonable and someone gets hurt, because that's a cost that affects us and prevents us from being able to run our business. Well, the deal is that every time that we pass an immunity bill, we insulate one group of people from the consequences of their unreasonable actions, and we deny another group of people compensation for losses that are caused by someone else. So that's the consequence of an immunity bill being passed. A provision that seems innocuous or seems to be beneficial to one group tends to pervert the incentives that we have in the civil justice system. As trial lawyers, we object to both of the consequences. We feel that our civil justice system is based on the principle that if someone acts unreasonably and thereby harms another, the wrongdoer and not the injured person should bear the cost. Pretty straightforward. If someone is hurt because I act unreasonably, I should be the one that's responsible for bearing the cost, not the person that's hurt. In so doing, we are able to disincentivize bad behaviors. We discourage bad behaviors and personal accountability of the people that are running the businesses, the agritourism or design professionals or whoever else. That their personal accountability for causing a harm is enforced. The immunity bills reverse these incentives, and they protect people from the consequences of their bad behaviors, pretty straightforward, and they limit innocent victims' access to justice. Now, there are all kinds of ways that innocent victims are already limited to the access to the court, and in our view, it makes no sense to continue to limit people's access to get compensation for harms caused by someone else. I don't want to encourage more immunity bills, but a couple of examples that I sort of dreamed up as I was thinking about this. If the legislature decides that we want to encourage the organic seed industry, pass a bill saying that if anyone's selling seed to farmers that's certified organic, then they would be immune from liability if the seeds fail to germinate. What we want to do is encourage that business. We want to, and so if you get the certification, which is like what the agritourism wants, is this notice up there, then you're immune from liability if the seed doesn't germinate. Well, the farmer plants the seed, it doesn't germinate, can't meet his contracts with the packers, loses the farm. Now, there's obviously no justice in that, and that would be that, and that's an example that by the absurdity shows how we need to be able to have the cost borne by the person who's causing the problem. Another example would be that if we wanted to encourage more better mileage or better miles per gallon in the state, well, why don't we give owners of Priuses liability immunity, because they're driving these cars that are getting great mileage, and that enhances the benefits of the whole state. Well, again, we wouldn't ever think of doing that if they cause an accident by running a red light or running a stop sign. Those are examples that in their absurdity show the problem with immunity fundamentally on a policy basis. Every special interest, every trade association, every business or organized group can make an argument at some point that their behavior needs protection. They're doing something that's good, something that's worthwhile, providing care to homeless vets or trying to develop the agritourism business or trying to do one thing or another. Every one of those arguments, though, ultimately suffers from the same flaw, and that is that they pervert the incentives to act reasonably and to have the person that actually causes the harm bear the cost that unreasonable behavior causes. So as the trial lawyers, you know, we see this all the time. We see people that are harmed by unreasonable behaviors, and frankly, I haven't seen much in the way of people being harmed in agritourism. I don't know if that's really a problem. Or if it's a solution looking for a problem. I haven't heard of any great liability problems for that industry. But I did hear the same comment from the insurance industry saying that the rates for agritourism are set nationally. Anything done in Oregon is not going to affect the rates here. The insurance industry doesn't set rates willy-nilly. They set rates based on the risks that they understand and that their actuaries put together. And if the rates are high, that reflects a risk in that industry, and it's a risk that the people that are conducting that industry should bear rather than the general public who is paying to go into those businesses. I'm available for questions. Thank you.
All right, questions. All right. I guess the chair has some questions regarding, and this may not be able to be answered now, but maybe through a sitting down with the parties, curious as to what the insurance rates actually are and how they have or haven't changed, knowing that there's more states that have passed this type of legislation. So I think that would be interesting to know. The equine limited liability that we already have in the state, I glanced at the statutes, and it looks like they've been in effect since 1991, and I'm just wondering if we know anything or can figure out anything as to how that has impacted protection for individuals who have gone to those locations and have been injured, being able to get redress. And then I also found it interesting in hearing Scotty's presentation that what she does as a landowner and operator actually has this danger tour, danger walk of taking people
seems to me that that shows, at least for her operation, she recognizes the issues and has taken, let's say, an affirmative step to ensure that people coming on the land understand these things before she actually lets them, I'm going to say, loose with the animals and stuff like that. So those are the type of things I guess I'm looking for. And if we're going to go down this road, it'd be interesting to me as to what the other states have done. Do they have these type of provisions that for someone to get these this protection, do they have certain requirements they have to meet to do so? And Derek and I both live in the Eugene community. There are places just north of town toward Junction City that have been in existence for many, many decades, family farms that do pumpkin patch stuff, the corn maze. And so it'd be interesting for me to know how they're operating now. I'm assuming they're covering some type of, carrying some type of insurance and stuff like that. So it seems to me that we should be, if we're really going to take a run at trying to come up with something that can be agreed to by all, that we look at what are the push points for the different interests, and are there some commonality that we might be able to give some type of relief if it's appropriate, and still understanding that I don't think it's the goal of anyone to say that someone who gets hurt in these arenas, that there are certain risks you take, but at the same time, there's certain obligations when you invite someone onto your property for compensation or whatever it may be.
Senator, just anecdotally from my own practice.
Let me do this, Derek. Scotty or Ivan, if one of the two of you want to come up to the table just to maybe have a little more exchange, we got a little bit of time. Let one of you two come forward.
Members of the committee, Senator Przanski, as to the equine statute, which has been in effect in 1999, in my practice alone, I've had over the years four different cases where people have been injured in equine centers. Who I've just had to tell, look, it's not even worth investigating that case because there's nothing to do pursuant to that statute. That's one office in one small town in the Willamette Valley in Eugene. I would be shocked if we could put together a comprehensive list of people who have been denied access because of that statute,
right,
simply because once they're denied access, there's no further record of it. So that's a little bit anecdotal, but nonetheless, it to me it's helpful because I look at that and I think, well, that, I mean, if you applied that to every other business that had to do with outdoors, pretty soon you'd be limiting a lot of people's rights. The other point I think that you raised, I think, is a valid point, and that is that it sounds like the witness who is running her agritourism business today is doing things reasonably, and that's the standard that people have to meet to avoid being held accountable if someone gets hurt. If someone gets hurt on their property and they've been doing everything reasonably, then there's no claim for them anyway. And a person would come into my office and they'd tell me what how they got hurt and what the agritourist operator was doing, and I'd say, well, that it sounds like what she was doing is reasonable, and you got hurt because of some inherent risk or some problem. We can't pursue a claim for you. A jury would never hold her accountable if she's doing everything right. So that sort of standard all on its own is able to eliminate the risk or the concern for people that are running these businesses. Again, that reasonableness standard is, I mean, it's been there since Blackstone, before the Pilgrims came over to the United States, and it's held the test of time pretty well.
Right. Ivan, any comments?
Well, again, Ivan Malusky, thank you, Senator Przanski. Those are good questions. I think that we're not aware of any substantial problems that have arisen from the equine statute, just to answer that question first. It has been in place for a long time. The way the law is currently written, it seems that if you are pulling your hayride or the tractor, you're at greater risk than if you're pulling it with a brake, with an emergency brake. You're at greater risk than if you pull it with a team of draft horses. Given the way that the current equine statute is written, you'd get protection if you had the draft horses, but you wouldn't if you had a tractor with actual working brakes. So that's, you know, there's sort of an incongruity there that is of concern to us. One actually seems safer, but it's not protected in this case. So we believe the bill actually does set out some standards that make sure that agritourism providers act in a reasonable manner. The requirement of conspicuous signage is an important one. The requirement that you not act in a willful or wanton disregard for people's safety, that you make known, that you're required to make known problems with, you know, any latent issues that may cause someone harm, and that you provide training and inspection of your equipment. These are all requirements that are very affirmative in the bill that we believe address some of those key questions. If there are some additional pieces to add to that, we're happy to talk about what those could be, but we believe the bill actually does set out a series of affirmative steps that a landowner would need to take in order to qualify for this liability protection. And lastly, all this really does is it provides an affirmative defense. If you have someone who's looking to sue you, it does put the burden a little bit more in the hands of the person who may be suing you to show that you were, you know, genuinely disregarding safety, that you weren't inspecting equipment, that you weren't posting the signs properly. So we think that that's where the standard should be, that you should be more protected when you have these opportunities on your property, and as long as you're taking reasonable steps. And again, the reasonable steps we believe are laid out in the bill. And lastly, on insurance rates, I don't think anyone really knows the true answer to this question. I think that when you do have only one or a handful of providers of this kind of insurance in Oregon, you don't have any competition, you don't have any ability to have rates go down based on those types of issues. And I think as more states adopt these, you may see some changes. This may be something that takes a few years to sort out. Nobody expects we're going to see overnight insurance reductions, premium reductions, but I think over time, that very likely could happen. And you know, this bill doesn't protect you from getting sued. It doesn't suggest it's not a best practice to have insurance, but we think it does provide some important protections, and is consistent with some laws already on the books around equine activities, as noted. And you know, we think long term, if we can do this sort of thing, I think it's a very realistic possibility that insurance options will broaden and rates could go down as well.
All right. Regarding the insurance rates, I guess it sounds like, Ivan, if your organization or group have already looked at this, I'd like to know what it is, because I'm hearing if 20 states already are doing it, you're now getting close to half the country. It seems to me we would see some type of changes in the practice as to what the rates would be. And if that's not the case, if we're looking at trying to do something, we need all the information we can get to ensure that it actually has goals that are attendant that are actually going to play out. Other questions? And just a question on the equine statutes. Do you know if it's limited to its application to adults versus children, or is there a distinction? We have not looked at it in detail, just heard about it, you know, really today.
Without having it in front of me, I couldn't tell you, Senator. I believe it's fairly broad, however.
Derek?
I don't know off the top of my head. I really don't. Sorry.
All right, any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you all very much for being here. I appreciate that. So I think that concludes the work that we have scheduled for today for judiciary. Tomorrow we're scheduled to start at 8:30. We are going to be taking up issues involving the DUII, IID instruments for both diversion and for conviction. So that should be quite interesting tomorrow. And we'll be adjourned until then. So thank you. Thank you.